The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You know, how many more smoking guns do you need? There have been so many stories told since NARA started looking into this. You have Trump telling the people assisting him what to tell NARA. There's just been a litany of false assurances that he didn't possess anything. It was all anodyne. And when you put it all together, it's going to be an amazing tale for any jury.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 6th, 2023. A meeting at the Justice Department between Trump's attorneys and special counsel Jack Smith may presage an indictment of the former president, or it may not. It's been a wild few weeks in the Mar-a-Lago investigation. Lordy, there are tapes. There's mishandling of security cameras. There's moving of boxes. There's an audio tape of a lawyer spilling his soul to an iPhone. There's all kinds of new information, and it's all coming out at the same time. Joining me in the virtual jungle studio before a live audience on YouTube and Zoom are Lawfare senior editors Scott R. Anderson, Quinta Jurassic, and Roger Parloff to talk it all through. We talked about the latest stories. We talked about all the threads and how they link together. And we took audience questions from a particularly engaged audience. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 6th, catching up with Jack Smith's Mar-a-Lago investigation. I want to start with a kind of weird overview of where we are, because as Scott said while we were getting ready, there are so many threads to this story that it is actually hard to keep them straight. So I'm going to start with a series of table-setting questions to each of you. Quinta, I'm going to start with you. What do we know about the meeting that took place at the Justice Department today? Is it just Jim Trusty whining about the special counsel to the special counsel, or is this an indication that an indictment is imminent?
It could be either one. I don't think it's really clear at this point. Certainly, it has been reported in the press that this meeting is a sign that special counsel Jack Smith's investigation is coming to a close, and that, you know, that this is a step that defense lawyers will sometimes take to try to meet with a prosecutor to persuade them, you know, one last ditch effort to persuade them that their client should not be charged. So I think there's, you know, you can look at it that way. You could also look at it and say, you know, Trump's lawyers love to huff and puff, or rather their client often asks them to huff and puff. And so, you know, kind of barging in the Justice Department, so to speak, and saying, you know, Donald Trump was the greatest president ever and did nothing wrong would be very much in character. That said, we have seen a number of other indications that things are wrapping up. I think mostly in the category of just a lot of news stories that suddenly appeared. It's been relatively quiet in the Mar-a-Lago investigation. And in the last week or so, couple of weeks, we've just seen a ton of reporting, including by CNN's Caitlin Palance, who is supposed to be at this event and unfortunately couldn't make it. And so if you view that alongside the reporting that Trump's lawyers are meeting with DOJ, I think you can definitely make an argument that, you know, something is coming down the pike. That said, I feel like we've all been in the place of saying, oh, you know, the indictment's going to drop any day now. And saying that, you know, day after day, month after month. So I don't want to go too far out on a limb with a prediction.
Roger, what do you think? Do you read the story this morning? I read the story this morning that there was a meeting at the Justice Department and said the only circumstances in which a meeting like this takes place is that a target letter went out last week and the Trump lawyers got the meeting they'd requested back in late May because a target letter had gone out. What do you think? Do you think it's just they sent a whiny letter a couple weeks ago and Jack Smith said, oh, come in, let's talk about it? Or Merrick Garland said, you talk to Jack Smith? Or is this a sign that we are, you know, not just at the charging decision point, but at the, you know, there has been a target letter and Trump knows he's about to get indicted stage?
I think this is the real thing, but I have no special expertise, except I haven't seen people go in and talk to the Justice Department like this unless they know that this is the last chance. So I'm assuming this is the real thing this time.
What do you think, Scott? Real thing or you know, just a chance to whine and complain at Jack Smith?
You know, there's always a bit of a black box we don't know, but it does make sense as a Hail Mary maneuver if you thought your client was about to be indicted by a special counsel. The attorney general, the person the letter and the request for a meeting was directed towards, is the only person who really has the authority to countermand the attorney general, even though it's a Hail Mary pass because the regulations state quite expressly that the attorney general is supposed to approach anything the special counsel recommends or wants to do, prosecutorial or investigation-wise, with a very, very deferential standard. And we've seen Garland apply that in other cases, like the Durham special counsel investigation, where he let not one but two prosecutions go forward that ultimately failed because they were not soundly constructed or pursued. Nonetheless, he deferred to the special counsel, in that case, special counsel Durham's decision to proceed. It'd be a real twist of fate for him to take a much less deferential standard here if Smith really is on the verge of taking the step. But it makes sense, given the structure of the special counsel authorities, that this would be the very last thing a desperate defense counsel might try and do to stave off that possibility.
All right. So let's, having now said a big somewhere between we're not sure and we think this is the real thing on the... what does the meeting this morning mean? Let's tack back now to the story that caused us to schedule this event in the first place. Roger, give us a bit of a, for those who missed the CNN story about the tape of Trump in the summer of 2021, what did the story report and why are people losing their heads over it?
Yeah, I guess this was... The report from Caitlin was that in about July of 2021, Trump was at Bedminster Club, his Bedminster Club in New Jersey, and was waving a document around and trying to refute something that Mark Milley had allegedly said about him, maybe with respect to being warmongering in Iran. And the document, as Trump seemed to be describing it, was supposedly some sort of plan about invading Iran. And he indicated that he understood that this was a classified document and he understood that it was too late to declassify it. And so all of that suggested that he understood that he had not, as Kash Patel has claimed later in about May of 2022, that Trump had very consciously declassified everything that he was taking out of the White House
That's what it looks like when you declassify something thinking.
I thought you were sending me a signal.
I'm just declassifying things.
Okay. So I think the defense that has given the government most pause is this theory that that somebody might support Trump's claim that he declassified a rash of documents before he pulled them out of the White House. And this was sort of smoking gun evidence that apparently he realized that he had not done that sort of thing, at least for this document. But to put this in time, this is July 2021. I mean, this is before the subpoena goes out. This is when he's still bickering with NARA. So this is very early on. You know, he lets NARA pick up 15 boxes at Mar-a-Lago in January 2022. They discover more than 100 classified documents in there. They notify DOJ. May 11th, the subpoena goes out to Mar-a-Lago for any remaining classified documents. June 2022, Jay Bratt from DOJ goes down to Mar-a-Lago, is given 38 more documents. On August 8th, there is the surprise search of Mar-a-Lago where they find another more than 100 classified documents. So I guess that's the timeline in broad brush.
And there's one more event actually worth adding on to the end of that that's been an issue, arguably two more. There was a voluntary search after the fact, after the August search by Trump's attorneys using private investigators that uncovered some amount of additional classified information that was handed back to DOJ. And then I'm a little confused whether this is separate or they're related to that, but there appeared to be some last dispute over a document that was found in Donald Trump's bedroom. Specifically, this led to the kind of notorious claim by one of his lawyers online that he was using a classified Redwell folder as a lampshade to block a light on a phone that was keeping him awake at night. And that was the document that they subpoenaed.
Look, we've all been there, Scott.
I actually have, as somebody who hates lights in their bedroom at night, but not with a classified document. But nonetheless, you know, I sympathize with that. But that there's these last little trickle of documents that still is coming in even after that August search by FBI agents at Mar-a-Lago.
All right. So, Scott, I want you to do the thing publicly in an outward-facing fashion that we did the other day in a Lawfare editorial meeting, which is try to figure out how this set of facts changes the Espionage Act evaluation if we assume the facts as CNN reported them true. It seems to me as we went through it, it actually changes it on all three prongs potentially. And I want you to walk us through the three prongs and really make vivid why prosecutors would be so interested in a tape that that exhibited the behavior that CNN reports here.
Yeah, I'm now am blanking on exactly the prongs as we broke them out, but I'm going to do my best and you can add one in if I slip up on one. The main way this really impacts thing, I think, is on the mens rea requirement. This is the challenge of Espionage Act prosecutions, of a lot of prosecutions. It's got a specific willful requirement, meaning the person being prosecuted has to have willfully unlawfully withheld national defense information or transfer them or done a number of other verbs with them. That's covered by the provision of the Espionage Act. It's 18 U.S.C. 793, if I recall correctly. And I think we think it's subprovision D, although that's not actually hasn't been specified anywhere.
It's E.
Thank you. E. But which is essentially having willfully withheld the documents after you know they've been asked back by the authorities. That seems like the easiest one to get across the line of all the different possibilities. But here you've got something a little more complicated. Previously, we had to rely upon circumstantial evidence to infer the mens rea, the mentality that you need to violate this crime. I actually think there's a pretty strong case there even before this revelation. But this revelation does the added benefit of being able to take it out of the realm of relying on circumstantial evidence and being able to have pretty direct evidence of an individual's mental state, meaning Donald Trump's in 2021 able to say, oh, I understand these are classified documents. Man, I wish I declassified them back in the day. That's what I think of at least this one document. And it's very hard to distinguish this one document from other documents. A second way this is significant is that this exchange happens at Bedminster, New Jersey. It does not happen in Mar-a-Lago. And of course, this raises the question of saying, well, if you're referencing this document, and we haven't heard this tape, but the way it's described is it sounds like Trump is talking about a document. He's holding his hand. And they even say in some of the reporting, you can hear him holding papers and manipulating them on the recording. We just don't know if this paper is, in fact, this four-page report purportedly written by Mark Milley, although Milley has actually said it was written by one of his predecessors. But if he actually has that classified document with him in Bedminster, that suggests that these documents walked and that he took them with him places. We know he did that in Mar-a-Lago. We know documents found their way into his private office and into his bedroom and over his phone and next to his bed. But now we know that they, in fact, wandered all the way up to New Jersey and potentially other places. That's a big problem in terms of the security of these documents. It means calls for a much broader scope of investigation. And recall that one of the complaints that we've heard from the lawyer, Tim Parlatore, who resigned from Trump's legal team, or at least attributed to him, is that people like Boris Epstein, one of Trump's senior advisors, were interfering with efforts to do full investigations of potential leaks of classified information, or meaning internal transfers of classified information at Bedminster and other places other than Mar-a-Lago. We're being very constrained and where they let them search. That's an issue we've seen come up again in Evan Corcoran's testimony, where he also said, I was really constrained, basically, in where Trump allowed me to search Mar-a-Lago and directed me to search Mar-a-Lago when I was looking for documents. So it's part of the seam saying maybe documents wandered other places. That itself is a basis for other potential Espionage Act violations in terms of your knowingly mishandling and dragging these informations around, and it means a lot bigger investigation. The third prong is he's showing these things to a private individual. We don't know exactly who these individuals are. They're involved presumably as ghostwriters or editors or publishers in this Mark Meadows biography, but they don't have classified clearances. That's very clear from the reporting. And if that's the case, showing this information really puts you into, at least at a minimum, a different prong of the Espionage Act. If it's national defense information you're knowingly sharing with someone who's not supposed to have it, that is another offense, not just willfully misholding it. So you might have an extra count or extra basis of securing an Espionage Act prosecution. It also opens up other criminal violations. 18 U.S.C. 798, a provision of a little lower in the U.S. code, not part of the original Espionage Act, but very similar, basically says for certain types of classified information, including communications-related evidence, cryptographic-related information, and then information derived from foreign government intelligence. And it's worth noting a lot of secret documents like this is foreign government intelligence. That's the default where FGI is supposed to be classified as kind of secret information. So it's plausible that that might be what's in this sort of thing. Then that becomes a criminal violation if you share that with third parties under a whole different provision, not one of the three original ones that were included on the search warrant for Mar-a-Lago last August. So in that way, it's pretty significant, all three of these. Whether this is a big delta shift beyond, you know, how much legal exposure Trump had then before this revelation depends on how strong you thought his defense was in the first place. I thought it was pretty weak in the first place. I thought there was really strong circumstantial evidence of the mental state from the outset. But helps that a lot.
But wait a second. It seems to me it's a little bit more significant than that, and not just on the mens rea question. Because it seemed to me before we had basically a pile of classified material that we didn't know, we didn't have direct evidence had been willfully retained rather than, say, accidentally packed up in boxes in a fashion more akin to Mike Pence or Joe Biden. We had some indication of that, like him telling people these are mine, or, you know, Kim Jong-un sent me love letters. I love that. You know, those are mine. But we didn't have like direct evidence that the original retention had been willful as opposed to careless or accidental. What we had was evidence that the refusal to yield it up was willful. And then there were efforts to obstruct the investigation. So I would say 80% of the investigation that we understood it was on the obstruction side. Now it looks like there's, you know, willful retention, willful transmission to parties not authorized to receive it, and refusal to yield it up, all of which are independently potential violations of the Espionage Act. No?
I don't disagree with that, but I'm not sure how big a difference that makes, because we already knew in 2021, Trump got a request from NARA saying, you've got these documents, you're supposed to give them back to us. And that was the negotiations. I'm forgetting exactly when it started, but I think it was in March or April of 2021. So at that point, I think you've got pretty strong circumstantial evidence that Trump is aware that he's got something he's not supposed to have. It's classified and he's supposed to deliver it up. So the delta really is that January to April window. That is significant. And you're right, maybe it could be the basis for an additional charge or something along those lines. But I still am of the view that the government had a pretty strong case, frankly, as far back as August on a lot of these points. But look, nobody likes to use circumstantial evidence when you don't have to. And for that reason alone, this tape's really, really useful in that regard. And as you noted, now they can point to lots of different parts of this exchange that could trigger the statutory requirements.
Roger.
Yeah, just one additional point. It also, there's an issue of prosecutorial discretion. Do you bring this case? And, you know, if this had really been a situation where, you know, why does he have these? Is it just because he's willful and these are mine and I want them as souvenirs? You might think, okay, maybe that's not worth the charging a former president. But if he's waving them around and showing people, it's just too reckless. You can't let this go on. I don't think you've ever had a case like that. It's another reason you must go forward.
Yeah, I think it's I have never seen a case like this not be charged. Query whether I've ever seen a case like this at all. But yeah. But when you're willfully retaining secret documents for purposes of sharing with ghostwriters with an obvious cognizance that it's secret, you're in prosecution land there.
I would say it's also worth noting that some of the material on potential obstruction, there's been new reporting that I think really augments that story. So the original documents that were filed by the government really describe a situation where Trump and his associates are repeatedly asked to relinquish this information and repeatedly refuse. And so that's pretty bad. But what we've seen is, for example, there's a report in the Washington Post about how workers at Mar-a-Lago moved the certain boxes into a sort of hidden area the day before the archives was supposed to show up. There's reporting there about Trump leading what the paper calls a dress rehearsal ahead of time, sort of getting ready to move boxes should anybody show up. Of course, I think there has been additional reporting that Trump at least looked over some of the documents in question, so he was aware that they were there. You know, I completely agree that if you kind of divide the document story into before or after, that we've been, you know, there's a lot of damaging stuff here on the before end, but I think there's also a lot more damaging stuff on the after end. And that honestly reminds me a lot of the Mueller report, right? That if you just read part one of the Mueller report, which is focused on Russian interference efforts and the Trump campaign's willingness to benefit from them and potentially cooperate, although that didn't pan out, it looks pretty bad. But then there's part two, which is Trump repeatedly trying to kind of throw up barriers in the way of investigators. And I think we're seeing that again now. And as was the case then, that it turns out it often is really magnifies just how bad the situation is. So I wouldn't say it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. I think in this case, it is the potential crime and the cover-up.
Although I think there's an important difference between this and the Mueller, which is that in that situation, the obstructions and the underlying questions were basically unrelated. Whereas here, I think the evidence of obstruction is actually evidence that bears on the mens rea of the underlying offense. That is, you know, if you retain classified information and then endeavor to obstruct the investigation and recovery of that classified information, that's itself evidence of willfulness with respect to the retention. And that's not true about the, at least not to the same degree with respect to the Mueller stuff.
Just a very small, Quinta misspoke. I think the bringing of the document into the storage room was the day before the DOJ came.
The
not,
brat,
not Nara. Yeah.
There are too many times when government investigators show up to keep track. Thank you, Roger.
One last point of significance, just to flag on this that I neglected, but we should mention the fact that if you can have a continuing offense or an offense that started earlier in the chain of custody of these documents dating back to when they were in Washington, D.C., actually could be significant from a venue perspective. It means that the locus of the criminal activity here is no longer so centrally located on Florida. This relates to a question Joyce asked that raised this, but you're absolutely, it's a very good question, Joyce. In fact, I think it does strengthen the case. Now, I'm not a venue expert, and I'm forgetting exactly where the line is and how you might distribute these. But I believe once you have a substantial element of related criminal acts in one location, the federal government can usually bring the charges there. Meaning if they can say, well, yeah, President Trump did something wrong in Washington, D.C. when he walked out with these documents, it may be a lot easier to bring a case in D.C. federal court as opposed to Florida federal court. That may be something they would much prefer to do.
Yeah, so we're going to come to Joyce's question a little bit later, so don't jump the gun on that, Scott. I want to zoom out to the other issues that have been percolating over the last couple of weeks, and what I'm going to do is go around the horn, Quinta, get us started, and give us your favorite new threads of this story over the last, I don't know, let's put a 2-week cap on it, nothing older than 2 weeks. And the one rule is you're not allowed to say anything that people before you have said. So Quinta, then Roger, then Scott, the floor is yours.
I just want to say that we were not told these rules ahead of time. So I have a list of recent news stories, but I cannot guarantee that they are all within.
No, you're going first. They're all new.
No, but they're not all within 2 weeks. So I do think for me, there has been kind of an interesting thread, and I'm going to set the table, but leave Scott some of the details that has to do with the role of Trump's fundraising after the 2020 election, where essentially this was flagged by the January 6th committee. I think Zoe Lofgren, Representative Zoe Lofgren, who's a member of the committee, termed it the big ripoff to go with the big lie. And essentially the argument that the committee made was that the Trump campaign was intentionally fundraising based on claims of election fraud that they knew were false. And I believe, and Scott can correct me if I'm wrong here, that there was at least one instance in which they were fundraising money to go into an entity that did not in fact exist or existed, but for a very different purpose. And you might hear me say that and think, that sounds a lot like wire fraud. And boy, it appears like it does. There is now it's been reported that the special counsel's office is looking into this. I think I've seen it reported both as kind of a subcomponent of the broader January 6th investigation and as a distinct kind of third prong of a three-prong investigation. So that would be money, January 6th, the actual insurrection, and Mar-a-Lago, which I think is just interesting that it has kind of come into its own in such a way. And the Washington Post had some interesting reporting about how listeners may have seen there's been some reporting about consulting companies that the Trump campaign hired to basically find evidence of election fraud, who both came back and said, we're really sorry, there's no evidence of election fraud. And that the Post reported that Smith was looking at those communications and that those organizations were cooperating and that might flesh out the wire fraud aspect of the story. So I hope that I haven't stepped on Scott's toes too much, but Ben, you did catch me unawares. And that's the story that I found the most interesting recently.
All right. So, but just to be clear, that we think is a story related to the January 6th investigation, not a Mar-a-Lago investigation story, right?
It grows out of January 6th.
Right.
Yeah.
But as far as we know, it's unrelated to the Mar-a-Lago investigation, right?
As far as we know, sorry, I didn't realize that you were confining it to Mar-a-Lago.
No, I'm not confining it to, I'm just trying to separate things because one seems to be in a more advanced stage than the other. Roger, what are the threads that have particularly grabbed you over the last couple of weeks?
Well, I'll just piggyback on to Quinta's, hopefully without violating your rules. Just one additional thing is that it's interesting that these reports, these consulting company reports, the Berkeley Group and a company called Simpatico, we didn't hear anything about this from the January 6th committee, which means that these documents weren't turned over for some reason, and they had to have been covered. And a lot of people knew about these. And so the fact that this didn't come out is sort of intriguing also. Earlier, another thing that's a little thread, you might remember in April 26th of this year. So this does go earlier than the 2 weeks, Parliatore, the then Trump lawyer, and a second lawyer wrote, a letter to a congressional permanent, intelligence committee, select Committee on Intelligence, criticizing this prosecution. And it was a 10-page letter, and it sort of lays out, you know, one of the hundreds of defenses that the various Trump lawyers have laid out, to various federal officials over the past 2 years. And this one involves how unfairly they were treated because NARA didn't tell them what to do the way it did with other administrations that were leaving the White House, and that this had something to do with the fact that the Trump administration had to leave in a hurry, unlike other administrations. And you're sort of slapping your head and saying, what? But in any event, of course, Parliatore is no longer there. And apparently, if the reporting is to be believed, I think this is from The Guardian, that Trump was very upset by what was in this letter, that it didn't seem entirely consistent to him with claims he wants to make or has made. And in any event, it's just one more piece. You know, when they tell this story, and this goes back to what Scott was saying about how many more smoking guns do you need? There have been so many stories told since NARA started looking into this. And you have Trump telling the people assisting him back then, people like Alex Cannon, what to tell NARA, and Alex Cannon refusing to do it. There's just been a litany of false assurances that he didn't possess anything. It was all anodyne. And when you put it all together, it's going to be an amazing tale for any jury.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Scott, you were saying before we went live that there were an amazing number of threads. Tick them off.
Well, let me try and tie a bunch of them together in what appears to be, I think, the heart of the investigation at this phase, the one that looks like it's closest to indictment, because it actually all boils down to a couple of days in June or maybe in May of last year, which is when M. Evan Corcoran, lawyer for Donald Trump, came to Mar-a-Lago to search through and conduct a search of these boxes of classified information that eventually resulted in the letter that Christina Bob signed on behalf of Donald Trump's as a custodian of his records to the government saying, oh, we've searched all these records, we found nothing. And of course, 2 months later, after the search warrant, FBI found many, many more. There's always been the heart of the case in a lot of ways, but we've seen multiple threads of investigation center around this couple days sequence of events. First, we have seen the reports the investigators are actively speaking to and have interviewed actually almost everyone who worked at Mar-a-Lago at the time, according to the Wall Street Journal, but specifically interviewed two people. One, a worker, I believe his name is Carlos de Oliveira, who says he actually helped a gentleman who was Trump's kind of valet during the White House and remains one of his senior aides, Walt Nauta, I may be mispronouncing that, apologies, who actually moved these boxes, a number of boxes, into the storage unit that Corcoran was going to testify before the day that Corcoran was there to search. It's implying that they were not always located there, that in fact they were located otherwise in Mar-a-Lago and were consolidated there. We also know investigators have been collecting security information from cameras in the vicinity of this closet, presumably to track what's coming in and going out and who had access to it and who didn't, right? Then Corcoran comes, he searches these boxes. We know from the resignation of Tim Parlatore that at least some members of the legal team had reservations about restraints that were put on them in terms of their ability to search other parts of the Mar-a-Lago estate. We have more reporting suggesting that Corcoran shared many of these concerns, expressed them and wrote them in notes, and in one case, one long verbal voice memo that he recorded into his smartphone while he was on a long drive to a family event, as it's been reported, creating a record expressing in great detail, which is described as almost novel-like narrative form, all of the work and restraints put on him by Donald Trump, all the work he's done for him, and very much, in many ways, details of their work together. These are the documents that we now know Judge Beryl Howell of the DC District Court said, you should disclose these to the grand jury and to the Justice Department in March of this year. While these would normally be protected by attorney-client privilege, I think the crime fraud exception applies to these because it looks like your legal services are being used pursuant to a criminal act by the former president or somebody close to his proximity, and therefore they do not qualify for attorney-client privilege. These are his records. In addition, there's the records of one other attorney as well, Jennifer Little, who appears to have played a much more minor role, but nonetheless had some sort of role in this sort of exchange. So now we know, essentially, it looks, or at least it closely sounds with reporting, that Corcoran was basically put into a closet, said, all the documents we have are here, search these closets, wrote a document saying, I've searched through all the boxes transferred from Washington, D.C. to Florida, not quite what he actually had individual knowledge of, but what he was told. He then gave it to somebody to sign. He wasn't willing to do it himself. I'm inferring that, but he didn't sign it at least. Then they said, well, who is going to sign this? Eventually, Christina Bob, a woman who kind of pops up time and time again as a close Trump confidant and loyalist, she also comes up in January 6th investigation a lot of places, was the person who signed it and handed it off. But we know it was inaccurate. And we know that somebody at Mar-a-Lago with the authority to boss people to move boxes around and to access the president's office and the president's bedroom where other classified records were eventually found, most likely, was directing the movement of these boxes and setting the constraints on who can search them. There's only one person who seems to be in a position to do that. And I strongly suspect Corcoran and potentially Little's records are going to confirm that. And so we see the pieces of the core parts of the criminal act here. This is a major obstruction offense. They're clearly trying to structure, as part of this dress rehearsal Quinta mentioned, the orchestration of how to manage these boxes. And so many of the threads feed into this sort of investigation. And that's the hub of what we're seeing. And I suspect that if we're going to see charges brought this week, that's what it's going to be around more than anything else, because it's so clearly a major focus of the investigation.
Quinta.
I just want to break in to say that CNN, including our dear Caitlin Palance, who is not here, just broke a story that an employee at the Mar-a-Lago residence drained the swimming pool last October and ended up flooding a room where computer servers containing surveillance video logs were kept. I can't even say that with a straight face. I'm reading from the story. Well, it's unclear if this room was intentionally flooded or if it happened by mistake. The incident occurred amid a series of events that federal prosecutors found suspicious. You don't say.
Amazing. I mean, amazing.
and of course, it is in the relevant period of time that Scott was just talking about.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. It looks like the flood was after
last October.
Trump had been subpoenaed for the video. I'm sorry. This is just like cartoonish. This is something that like G. Gordon Liddy would have come up with. Incredible. I will put the link in the chat for everyone who is watching the Zoom.
All right. So let's talk about what an indictment would look like. Because it seems to me between the first half of this conversation where we talked about the Espionage Act side and the second half, which is all about the obstruction side, you actually have an incredible statement of facts that, assuming you can substantiate this stuff, is a 70-page novella of a statement of facts in an indictment. And it doesn't actually seem to me like it has a lot of holes in it if you mentally fill it in with stuff that Evan Corcoran's notes must say or are likely to say. So I'm curious, Roger, where, if at all, do you see vulnerabilities in this two-part story, one focused on the illegal retention and use of these documents and hoarding of these documents and refusal to return? And the second half focusing on the efforts to obstruct the investigation and recovery of them. What's the missing piece in your mind?
As far as obstruction, I don't have a missing piece. As far as the classified, I think their greatest fear is the one that the Caitlin's recording helps diffuse, which is the fear that somebody is going to come forward and support his claim that Trump's claim that he declassified documents in some sense before he left, because he does have broad power, even though it's not usually done that way. He has to have that power when he's president, and so I think that's the biggest hole they have to be able to meet. They've got a lot of witnesses that say it, they never heard about this and it doesn't pass the laugh test. But the fact is he has enormous power to declassify. I think he has to tell somebody, but beyond that, it doesn't have any formalities that are required.
You don't think the brainwaves theory of declassification works?
I doubt that's sufficient, yeah.
All right, Quinta, what do you think? What's the part that when you think about the story as told in the press, there are still missing pieces to Quinta Jurassic, federal prosecutor?
Well, I will try to channel the very smart people who discuss this on Twitter, and I will say I'm less familiar than Scott with the ins and outs of the Espionage Act. So Scott, you should once again correct me if I put a foot wrong here. But my understanding is that there has to be some kind of showing that Trump intended to violate the law, and certainly among folks who know things on Twitter, they've pointed to that as kind of the the difficult part, as it always is with Trump, right? When you need to provide some kind of proof of what's going on in there. And I do wonder whether the recent reporting also about how Jack Smith has been looking into Trump's business dealings abroad may play into that, if they're trying to kind of tell a story about why he was doing this, that shows that he was intentionally violating the law. That is my impression, that there is, you know, that the sort of willfulness will be a problem there. That said, I know that not everybody agrees with that. The best I can do is kind of a shrug, but my impression is that that's where people feel that it's shaky. And then the other thing is also that, you know, having a Espionage Act charge or charges along with an obstruction charge or charges, my impression is would make for a much stronger case, and that they really would need to build out the obstruction side. It certainly seems like there's more and more evidence on that front, especially with this pool flooding. But it does seem like this is a sort of, you know, there's a force multiplier aspect where if they can't get either one, that might diminish their willingness to move forward with a case on the remaining charge, if that makes sense.
Scott, what would you be worried about if you were the wizard Jack Smith?
Yeah, you know, I am really not. I think the conventional thing people say they're worried about are these broad claims of declassification authority and what that means for mens rea. Could Trump have acted in good faith on his belief that he had declassification authority, even if he didn't? And that defeats his mens rea, right? I think that was his best defense before this recent tape came out. Even before then, I don't think it's a good defense. I don't think it's been a good defense since day one. I wrote a piece about it. I think day two, the story came out about why I thought it was complete nonsense, at least in part because on January 19th, 2021, Trump's second to last day in office, he declassified a binder of Crossfire Hurricane information. And how did he do it? He issued an executive order to do it, like a normal person, not because he had some mental powers to declassify things. So it's very hard to reconcile that with his subsequent behavior. But it is circumstantial evidence. Now that we have this recording, you don't even need that circumstantial evidence. You've got pretty direct evidence of his intent. All evidence of mens rea is technically circumstantial, but nonetheless, much less circumstantial. It requires much less inference. The remaining gap here, I actually think, is much narrower, and it has to do with the obstruction charge. We have all the pieces of representations about Christina Bob's letter, the moving of the boxes, the security cameras. We have reporting about all these pieces of evidence around that key day that is essential to any major obstruction charge, but also the strongest sort of evidence there. The only thing we don't have is directions from Donald Trump directing it all to happen, right? We're inferring that still. And that is always the thing that's hard to pin Donald Trump down on from prior investigations. In the Ukraine conflict, we couldn't get to it. In January 6th, you can't get to it. Now, but in both those cases, he had executive privilege guiding and protecting efforts to inquire into his internal communication with people around him. He doesn't have that anymore now. And I strongly suspect, frankly, they've got testimony from people about him directing them in this role, because they're going to face individual criminal liability if they don't have that, or if they don't produce that, then it's going to fall on them. And people like Christina Bob and other folks who are going to find themselves on the line for Donald Trump if they don't flip and say, well, he instructed me to do this. I was acting on his warranties, his certifications. We know Bob herself has spoken to prosecutors twice, at least once before a grand jury. I suspect that's what it was about, but it doesn't have to come from her. There are other people around who may be less loyal, less blindly loyal, and a little more commonsensical to say this is not the right thing to do. And I don't owe this man any more than he gives me. And it's time to tell the truth. And I think they have that testimony, but that's the part that the gap that I want to see them fill to bring charges around this most developed part of the investigation. There are other threads. The financial thread, the January 6th thread, it looks like I haven't seen any signs anything's imminent there. If there's anything imminent, it's just around this Mar-a-Lago charge. And it may just be around, frankly, this obstruction of this particular certification, because it's so in the face of the FBI. It's the sort of thing that I could see a DOJ making a priority. But around that, that's the only real gap. Other than that, I think they got a pretty good case, it seems to me.
All right. We are going to go to audience questions. Joyce, you have the first question, to which we have already alluded in prior parts of the conversation.
Sorry. Clearly, a jury pool coming from Florida becomes a little bit of an iffy thing, not to mention judges like Eileen Cannon floating around. So I'm wondering if the existence of potential documents at Bedminster gives the DOJ a choice of venue that's not Florida.
Yeah. So, Scott, I have some venue thoughts. You mentioned some venue thoughts earlier. Why don't you start and I'll pick it up?
Sure, absolutely. I think it's a really good question. And frankly, it might be the more significant implication of this particular finding in a way. Because again, I think they had plenty of factual predicates for Espionage Act charges before. But that this and 798 charges, the separate provision for specifically classified information, this could be a big game changer for. Because if you accept that, in fact, the clearly criminal act Donald Trump did wasn't just retaining documents after he was aware that he had them, which we can only prove happened sometime in after he returned to Florida. If it was when he walked out of the White House with them, that means you've got a tie of this relate. You can tie this related criminal conduct to Washington, D.C., and you can make an argument for venue there. I am not confident of my mastery of venue. Brandon Van Grack wrote a very good article for us at the end of last year on this exact question, although without these facts yet evident to us, for Lawfare, along with the co-author's name, I'm escaping, apologies for that. I would refer you to that to take a look. I think he does a good job breaking it down. I'm a non-litigator. I do not have much exposure to venue questions, but I do know it hinges on essentially the nexus of the criminal conduct. And my recollection is that federal prosecutors have a fair amount of discretion once they can have substantial weight to at least one particular venue. And so I suspect if you can tie these charges to Washington, D.C., they got a reasonable argument at least to be able to bring venue there. Does that sound right to you, Ben?
Yes. And I also think that the fact that if you believe you can show that the initial decision to retain the documents was made by Trump when he was president, right? Because that's when he did it. That action happened in Washington. And then you can establish venue in Washington. If you think that the action really only begins in Florida after a large-scale accidental withdrawal, maybe by staff that Trump had nothing to do with, then I think venue in Washington becomes more difficult. Roger?
Yeah, I read that article more recently, I think, and it is troublesome what Brandon was saying in terms of getting it out of Florida, if you want to put it that way. Because the crux of the 793E charge, which is what we all think is the crux of the indictment, is unlawful retention. And that you know, occurs in Florida. There are other charges that could be brought, including if other people are involved, you could charge conspiracy to commit that crime. And then every overt act becomes, if the overt act is in Washington, and a tremendous number of them are, they're misrepresentations that are submitted to Washington, then that will give you a venue. There's a lot of additional charges, false statements, 1001, those are submitted in Washington. So those would give you DC. But the way he described it, at least, and I'm not an expert either, but Brandon said that, each charge needs to have a proper venue. And so you don't want to, and it could be dismissed, and then you would be left handling the other cases, the other charges. It could even be that they would lie low and not try to dismiss it and then bring it up when it's about to go to the jury and say, you haven't proven venue. That can be something you need to prove to the jury. So it's a big problem. And I think it's so unlikely that they would bring this in Bedminster, in New Jersey, based on this one charge. So I don't think it really helps.
All right, Dan. You have the next question.
Thanks. So there's been a lot of reporting about the video at Bedminster, obviously, with this discussion. However, there's also been reporting that the documents were subpoenaed and Trump's lawyers were unable to find them. If those documents end up not existing, whether or can't be found, how would that affect the prosecutorial usefulness of any audio recording that is obtained of Trump?
Super interesting question. Quinta, Scott, Roger, any of you have thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it's a great question, I do wonder whether the absence of the document could potentially add to the obstruction case. If, you know, you argue, we know that this was there because he's talking about it and we can't find it. And that certainly speaks to a level of, at the very least, carelessness, but in, you know, context of the broader pattern of obstruction, a willingness to squirrel away classified documents and not hand them over.
Yeah. And I would say, I think that's right. It does seem the government, I believe we have reporting to this, although I actually think it's, I saw it on Twitter so, as opposed to an article, so you always have to take a little bigger grain of salt, is that the government seems to know what this thing is. They've seen it. They have their copy. What they don't have is evidence that Trump's been able to locate his copy, right? But they know it exists and they know they have it. We've seen it described in some detail down to Milley saying, oh, yeah, Trump, Mark Meadows' book said I wrote this, but I didn't. Dunford actually wrote this before I came into office, right? And so, you know, what they really got to show is that there should be a sign that this was among the documents that Trump took. I think the detailed description of Trump gives, if the reporting is accurate about that, is probably enough, if particularly if they're willing to produce the underlying document, because they can really clearly say, look, Trump obviously had this thing. He's describing it. Here you see a copy, jury. And because it's a secret document, because it's at a high level, and because they may be able to redact some of the more sensitive proportions, they may be able to or willing to do that. In this way, it's actually might be beneficial. That's only a secret document, not a top secret document. Secret documents much easier to declassify, usually, especially when you can extract, you know, redact certain parts of it that might be more sensitive. So they might be able to do that. But it does complicate things a little bit, but I don't think in any fatal way.
I just don't see it's relevant to its central value to the case, which is to show that that Trump understood that he had not declassified documents, that, you know, he's holding something then and there, even if we don't have it anymore. And I sort of agree with Quinta, the fact that he can't even account for it just makes this all the more grave and serious. But the crucial point is his state of mind, that he understood, no, he didn't have Kash Patel declassify anything and everything that he was taking out to Mar-a-Lago. That was false.
All right. We're going to go to try to get through everybody. So we're going to go to quick questions and quick answers. Jared, the floor is yours.
So I've seen some of the reporting that has discussed in sort of vague terms what the participants of the meeting were able to see, that they saw Trump waving around a document. But I haven't seen anything clearly stating that the participants at the meeting were able to definitely see what was in the document or how closely Trump actually described it. Does that change how Trump's defense attorneys would approach that? And then also, would the DOJ need to give participants at that meeting immunity to testify, or for that matter, also Mar-a-Lago employees immunity to testify if they did see details on any of the classified documents?
Okay, so I can take this one. First of all, it's not illegal to receive information that's classified from, say, it's illegal to disseminate it to us, but to be a person who receives it is not a violation of the Espionage Act. And so it's not clear from that story that those individuals would have done anything wrong. And remember, they are presumably, you can stick them in front of the grand jury and ask them, hey, or have an FBI agent interview them. Hey, did you ever learn what the substance of those documents were? Which, by the way, at some level of generality, they clearly did, because that document is actually described in Mark Meadows' autobiography, which they were writing. And so the question is, at what level of generality was the document described to them, and did that constitute a conveyance of classified information? And the special counsel has many ways of finding that out, all of which should be transmissible to a jury. Simon, you have the next question.
Thank you. I'm wondering, to try to tie these threads together, is there any known evidence or reporting that among the documents that appear to be missing may be requests for presidential pardons related to actions that took place in the aftermath of the November 2020 election. I also had a short question about whether or not, if Trump is charged in the documents matter, whether or not any of his lawyers are likely to also face charges.
Who wants to take this? These two?
I can take I guess I could take both. For your first question, I haven't heard any. I don't think there's any reason to believe the documents are implicated at all in this. I could be wrong, but I haven't seen any sign of it. But other folks, feel free to contradict me. On the latter point, the lawyer is facing charges. That's definitely a possibility. But frankly, it's one that at least M. Evan Corcoran appears to have been very concerned about, which is why he recorded this long voice memo and took a bunch of notes about his proceedings. Like, a classic thing to do if you're a lawyer and you're worried you're in legal peril is you write a lot of notes to self, because it means that you're memorializing your intent and the subjective moment and clarifying, here's what I'm doing and why I'm doing in detailed ways. And it creates a record that you can't destroy without obstructing justice, and people can then subpoena. If I'm being honest, like, I think Corcoran knew there's a chance this stuff is going to be subpoenaed. I'll defend it against attorney-client privilege, but the court determines crime fraud. I got to hand it over. Sorry, Mr. Client. I was just taking duties notes because I'm a lawyer, right? It goes back to kind of like the began, I'm a real lawyer, I take notes sort of argument back from the Trump time in this White House. So there is a possibility lawyers could face charges here if they were part of this conspiracy, like anybody else. It looks like Corcoran is very conscious about trying to evade that. But again, I have to say, the disclosure letter that he wrote, that Christina Bob then signed, is very cagily worded in ways that you could construe as being intended to deceive. Because it says, again, we search all the boxes that came from Washington, D.C. to Florida. And it's not clear that's 100% what actually happened. And why would he author something to represent it? But then he didn't assign it. So again, it's possible. I think it's something they seem to be aware of. Now, Christina Bob maybe has other issues. Other folks seem to have other issues that might implicate them as well. But at least in this case, the lawyer is most directly implicated, other than her, appear to have taken some steps to try and insulate their individual legal liability.
Roger, very quickly.
The account that in the reporting on what Chief Judge Beryl Howell wrote in her ruling when she ordered it turned over, even though it was an attorney document because it was within the crime fraud exception. She was very clear, apparently, that she felt that Evan Corcoran was the victim here, that he was a casualty of Trump misleading him. So I don't, and I sort of suspect the same with Christina Bob as well. The reporting, at least, makes them all look like victims.
All right, Auntie, on behalf of the newest member of NATO, the nation of Finland, you get the last question today.
Thank you. If Trump had preemptively pardoned himself against any upcoming potential charges, would we have found out already? Thank you.
All right. So first of all, maybe not. If he had, if the last thing he had done after squirreling away the classified documents was to sign a pardon to himself, stick it in his pocket, and squirrel it away too. It's possible we wouldn't know that, but remember that document could not. You can't pardon future activity, right? And so, you know, if he did that on January 20th at 11:59 a.m. as Joe Biden was walking out to take the oath, that would not protect him against the 2022 activity that is the centerpiece of this investigation. Okay, we are going to leave it there. Roger Parloff, Scott R. Anderson, Quinta Jurecic, thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. And if you're watching this live, you're probably already a material supporter of Lawfare. But if you're not a material supporter of Lawfare and you're hearing this on the podcast, become one now. Join the Patreon or the Substack, the Material Support Program. It's a federal felony to give material support to a designated foreign terrorist organization, but it is a virtue to give material support to national security publications like Lawfare. So do it. The Lawfare podcast benefited enormously from the engineering on the Zoom side of Anna Hickey and on the Goat Rodeo, the Zencaster side of the estimable Mr. Noam Osband. The Lawfare podcast is edited by the long-suffering Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by the even longer-suffering Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.